Previously on The Accidental Terrorist.
The year is 1987, the time late February. Our hero, Elder Bill Shun, an outwardly devout 19-year-old from Utah, has been called to serve 2 years as a missionary in the wild and foreign land of Alberta, Canada. Severely homesick, he has already attempted to flee his mission, only to be turned back and convinced to give it another go. But then, faced with another missionary, Elder Finn, trying to run away, Elder Shun does the unthinkable. Phones in a bomb threat in a last-ditch effort to keep Finn from leaving. Arrested and booked for public mischief, Elder Shun is now free on bail, having spent a long night in the Calgary City Jail. But now, the newly minted criminal must face his fellow missionaries.
The Accidental Terrorist. A memoir by William Shun. Chapter 31.
Bad Things.
According to the clock in the main lobby of the remand center, it was after 1 when I stepped out of the elevator. No one was there waiting for me. No President Tuttle, no Elder Snow, no one. Apparently, I was on my own to find a way back to the mission office. I felt more bereft than I had in jail. I wandered up and down the block. The sunlight seemed foreign, the people walking past me alien. I considered taking a C train back, but I had no idea how close to the mission office that would put me. The bus system was completely unknown to me. Finally, I retreated to the lobby of the remand center, dug some coins out of my plastic bag, and called the mission office. Aged Elder Farnsworth, the senior missionary assigned to the office, was the only one there. Everyone else had returned to the second day of the leadership conference. It took some doing to convince Farnsworth to drive downtown and pick me up, but I managed it. No one cares about me, I thought as I waited for Farnsworth's big, unwieldy Buick to arrive. I'm less a person now than I was yesterday. I could drop dead right here, and no one from the mission would care. The apes wandered into the mission office at about 3:30. Elder Farnsworth and I had been back since 3, and I was in the front room playing a jazzy little tune on the piano. Atop the piano sat a copy of the Calgary Sun I had bought outside the remand center while I waited for my ride. My name was mentioned on the front page of the metro section, beneath a full-color photograph of an airplane surrounded by emergency vehicles. The paper had also printed the address of the building where I lived.
Elder Shun, cried Elder Fearing. How are you? Are you all right? Yeah, I'm fine, I said. I stood up from the piano and both elders rushed over to throw their arms around me and pound me happily on the back. Oh man, we're glad you're okay, said Elder Hardy. This must have been way scary for you. I mean, being in jail and all. What was it like? I felt subdued when I spoke, muted, as if somebody had wrapped a muffler around my emotions. The someone was probably me, keeping myself from losing my shit. It was pretty weird, I said, my voice sounding somehow diminished. Pretty scary. Lots of really scary people. Did you teach any D's? Asked Fearing eagerly. Just about, I said. There was this guy in my holding cell, and I was just starting the first D with him when the guards came and moved him upstairs. Bummer, said Fearing. A for effort, though, said Hardy, and gave me a high five. Were you scared, like, all the time? Pretty much, I said. Not always. I mean, the worst thing about jail really isn't being scared. It's not knowing what time it is. Didn't you have your watch? Asked Fearing. No, they took it away. No way, said Hardy. Yeah, they took my tie and my belt and my name tag, too. You're kidding, said Hardy. Did you get fingerprinted and everything? Sure, I said. My self-confidence was creeping back in from its vacation, prodded by the obvious amazement and admiration of the apes. They took my fingerprints and my mugshots. They strip-searched me, too. No flippin' joke, said Elder Fearing. You mean they... He made a thrusting motion with his index finger. Pretty close, I said. You had to get naked? Asked Hardy. I mean, geez and all? Oh, man, let me tell you, I said. and I proceeded to relate the entire story of my strip search, pantomiming the process in excruciating detail. The apes hung on my every word. When, bent over, I got to the part where the guard told me to put my hands on my cheeks and spread them, they just about fell down laughing. "Boy," said Fearing, wiping his eyes, "you're lucky you didn't get the old backdoor burglary." "Yeah, talk about turning the other cheek," said Hardy, and we all doubled over again. When the chuckles trailed off, Elder Fearing said, "You know, Shun, everyone here's been awfully worried about you. In fact, Sister Tuttle had a great big breakfast planned for us at the conference this morning, but everyone voted to skip it and fast for you to get out of jail instead. A lot of people here really love you, man." Tears stung my eyes. Fasting was a serious business, not to be undertaken lightly. The fact that a few dozen ravenous missionaries had skipped breakfast to try to attract God's attention on my account touched me very deeply. "Hey, Buckfart!" cried Elder Snow, who walked in just that moment with Runaway McKay. "How's our favorite criminal mastermind?" "Snow!" I cried. I was thrilled to see him, and I threw my arms around him. "You sure know how to start a ruckus, Jacko," said Snow, stepping back and gripping me by the shoulders. His grin exposed all 32 teeth. "So what's the deal, anyway? You straighten out those buggers down at county? Teach them some flippin' D's?" Before I could answer, Elder Fearing, barely able to control his excitement, said, "Shun, you gotta do the strip search thing for Snow and McKay." I put up a modest and false show of reluctance. Within 30 seconds, all four elders were begging me for the strip mime. So I did it again, this time with added flourishes. More elders returning from the leadership conference filtered in during the act, and by my third run-through, I was performing for a crowd of a dozen and a half, all laughing and hooting and whistling with relish. It almost made the whole adventure worth the trouble. I was relating further adventures in incarceration to my most gracious audience when Roper, Steed, and Herzog walked in. Seeing me, they burst into tears in unison and hurried over. They would have hugged me if there hadn't been so many elders around, I was sure. "Oh, Elder Shun, it's true. You're safe," cried Sister Steed. "Oh, it must have been so horrible," wept Sister Herzog. "Oh, Elder, we're so sorry," sobbed Sister Roper, wringing her hands. "This is all our fault. If only we hadn't..." Her words dissolved into inconsolable blubbering. "No, no, sisters," I said, trying to quiet them down. "It wasn't your fault at all. You were just trying to help. The bomb threat was all my idea. Really. Please, stop. Please." After the sisters had calmed down a little, and after Sister Roper had asked me if I'd taught any discussions in jail, someone spilled the beans about the strip mime. I had to go through the whole routine one more time, and damned if the sisters didn't laugh harder than anyone. It was just after I finished that President Tuttle entered the room. "Oh, Elder Shun, good, you're here," he said. "Could you please see me in my office for a minute? Elder Snow, you too. And Elder Fearing and Elder Hardy? Thanks." "President Harvey has been working hard on getting things expedited for you, Elder Shun," Tuttle told me when his office door had closed behind us all. "You'll be happy to know your initial court date is tomorrow." "Holy crow," I said. "Talk about swift justice." Tuttle settled himself behind his desk. "Yes, well, the way I understand it, this is simply where you choose how you want to be tried, before a jury or just a judge or what. It's not like in the United States. But we'll talk all that over tomorrow with Fred, I'm sure." "Okay," I said. "Meanwhile, gentlemen," he said to us all, "we have something of a dilemma. President Harvey informs me that Elder Shun's work visa is suspended pending the outcome of his court appearances. That means he's not allowed to proselytize. We can't put him back with you, Elder Snow, and expect you to stay idle, so at least until his father arrives tonight, I'm assigning Elder Shun to a three-leg with the APs. He can't do any work, but at least he won't be a hindrance, since the two of you are here in the office." "But we have an appointment tonight," I said. the Buckinghams. It's their fifth discussion. I'm sorry, Elder Shun, but I can't let you go out and teach. You can't risk getting caught without a work visa. Elder Snow cleared his throat. It doesn't matter anyway, he said. I talked to the Buckinghams today, and well, he shrugged. I don't know how to tell you this, Shun, but they don't want any more discussions. My mouth fell open. He grinned. At least not until you're free, bucko. They told me they refused to take another discussion from anyone but you and me, together. Wow, I said. I thought my chest would burst. That's another reason to pray for Elder Shun's deliverance, said President Tuttle. Elder Snow, you stick with Elder McKay for the time being. When this whole legal mess is over, we'll get all the companionships sorted out. With that business out of the way, Prez and the others brought me up to speed on the details of their previous night's activities. President Tuttle and Elder Bruce, hung up in evening traffic, had not arrived at the airport until 10 or 15 minutes after 6 by their account. As they approached the customs area, Bruce spotted two men disappearing into a dim corridor beyond the gate. Hey, President, isn't that Elder Shun down there? President peered through the shuttered gate, but the two men had disappeared. I don't know. I can't see anything. Their cries for assistance drew the attention of a bearded man in an orange windbreaker, my old friend the Stephen King lookalike. The man was surly and cross, and his only response to President's desperate inquiries was to say that another of you Mormons had been there but was gone now. President at last prevailed upon the man to check the international departure lounges for Stuart Finn, who may or may not have already boarded his flight. Acting greatly put upon, the man set off, returning several minutes later to report that Finn didn't want to talk to anybody from the church. Confirmation of Finn's presence only fueled President's determination to see him. As soon as the man in the orange windbreaker was gone, President asked Elder Bruce to give him a boost. A boost? Asked the incredulous Bruce. Yes, a boost. I'm going over this gate. I could only imagine the comic delights of the scene that followed. Rotund, Tweedledum-like President Tuttle stepping on Elder Bruce's head as he hoists his bulk up that curtain of metal links. Prez, poised, shaking, at the top of the gate, rattling it like a maraca as he tries to steady himself. Prez, clinging to the far side, baboon fashion, before plopping to the floor like rotten fruit. Elder Bruce waits anxiously as President rushes off to the gates, only to see him escorted back by the man in the orange windbreaker and an armed security guard who's shouting, "This is a sterile area! This is a sterile area!" What a hoot! Given the circumstances, Prez was lucky that he didn't get arrested himself. Instead, the guard simply unlocked the gate and ejected him from the customs cordon. Out of options, Tuttle and Bruce turned around and left the terminal. That's when they spotted the Ares K, still parked in the loading zone, and started wondering what had become of me. If I wasn't waiting for them at the gate, and if I hadn't driven away in the car, might I be leaving with Elder Finn on the next plane? Meanwhile, Finn was having problems of his own, or so Prez had learned by phone. Not only was the flight Finn so desperately needed to catch delayed, but the police were starting in on him, apparently hoping both to confirm my confession and to rule out the possibility of a conspiracy. A couple of officers tracked down Finn and hauled him off for questioning. They bombarded him with questions like, "What do you know about this bomb?" and "What kind of game are you playing here?" and "You're in this with your Mormon friend, aren't you?" At last, with no good reason to hold him, they returned the shaken elder to the departure lounge. Occidental Flight 789 finally took off after a 90-minute delay. When it landed in Salt Lake, Elder Finn was one of the few passengers who stood even a remote chance of making his connection. But as he exited the jetway, someone stepped up to block his path. "Elder Finn," said the craggy, steel-haired man before him. "I'm Milton Farrow. I used to be mission president in Calgary. Why don't we take a walk, son?" "I got a plane to catch," said Finn, pushing past him. "You want to talk to me? Keep up." And he took off running, OJing for all he was worth. President Farrow, like a barking drill sergeant, kept pace. Breathless, he tried to convince Finn that this wasn't the right way to leave his mission, that he should do the honorable thing and go back out. Farrow had a plane ticket in hand. He offered it to Finn. When Finn refused it, Farrow told him God was very disappointed. In turn, Finn called Farrow a mean old bastard and told him all the missionaries who remembered him hated his fucking guts and were glad he was gone. I didn't find out if President Farrow stayed with Finn all the way to the gate or not, but he sounded like the kind of person who would. I did find out that Elder Finn made his connection and arrived home safely in Fresno late that night. "I'm sorry to tell you that, Elder Shun," said President. "I know you did your very best." Finn had made it home. I didn't know whether to feel chagrin or admiration. "Now," said Prez to me, waving the other elders out, "there's one more thing I need to talk to you about." I was playing piano late that evening, this time at the Black Baby Grand in the Tuttle's living room, when the front door of the house opened. President Tuttle entered the living room a few moments later. "Elder Shun," he said, removing his coat, "look who's here." My father loomed in the entryway behind him. I rose stiffly from the piano. "Hello, son," my father said, stepping into the room. He wore his favorite sheepskin jacket over a white dress shirt and tie. His bald head shone red from the evening's chill. I stepped away from the piano. My father took me in his strong arms, and he told me he loved me and everything was going to be fine. For at least that moment, I was four again, and my father was the wisest, most powerful man in the world. For at least that moment, I knew he could still protect me, and that everything would turn out fine. Sister Tuttle and the apes were in the kitchen. I introduced my father, and he politely declined Sister Tuttle's offer of a piece of chocolate cake. A sure sign he was as unsettled as I. After a few minutes of small talk and a few glowing reports of my value as a missionary, the apes had excused themselves and drove home. President Tuttle escorted my father and me to the guest rooms downstairs, separate rooms, perhaps indicating how far outside mission norms we had moved. After showing us where the linens and towels were kept, President said, "I'll just get out of your way now. I'm sure you both have plenty to catch up on. We can talk about business in the morning." President padded up the carpeted stairs, and I shadowed my father into his room. It was a tidy little box, warm, almost plush, done in yellows and blues and smooth pine. It smelled of lemon and dust and wood shavings, and was too close for two men to inhabit without some attempt at talk. "Your mother sends her love," said my father, laying his suitcase out on one of the twin beds. "She's thinking about you and praying every minute." "That's good," I said, hovering near the door. "Did you have any trouble, getting time off from work?" "No, I managed to find a substitute," said my father. "You remember Cobb Sanders, I think. He's got my classes." "That's good. He'll cover me as long as it takes." I felt a stab of guilt. I hoped my father had enough vacation days for this. He hung a couple of shirts in the closet. "So, you know, that girl you used to run around with, what's her name?"
Katrina?
"Yeah, Kanisha, that's the one." I sighed. "Katrina. Yeah, exactly." He fished around in an outside pocket of his suitcase and retrieved a large white envelope. I recognized the looping cursive spelling my name on the front. My heart skipped a beat. My father spoke with his chin tucked down in the offhand tone that meant he found the topic at hand uncomfortable. I guess your mother must have called her and told her something. She came around late this afternoon, before I left for the airport. Brought this over for me to give you. He handed me the card. Thanks, I said, exerting all my will not to rip the envelope open right then. My father went back to his suitcase. I don't think she's taking all this very seriously, he said without looking at me. All the time she was at the house, she couldn't stop giggling. Giggling like those girls do in my classes. Women, I said dryly, and made as if to leave. Are you going to bed? Asked my father. Yes, I said. I made a show of yawning. I didn't get a lot of sleep last night. They're, in the jail. Let's say our prayers before we turn in. He knelt and I joined him. Hands clasped behind our backs, we closed our eyes and bowed our heads. My father offered a solemn prayer in which he asked God to be with us and to comfort our family and to keep me out of prison. I seconded the motion with a somber amen. We stood and said goodnight, and I left him to his luggage. Already our rift was reopening. My room was done in blue and red plaids, from the walls to the curtains to the bedspreads. The overhead light was turned off, but the lamp on the nightstand between the twin beds gave the room an intimate, comforting glow. I didn't bother unpacking my overnight bag. I just laid the envelope on the bed farthest from the door and knelt to offer my personal evening prayer. When that was done, I stripped to my garments, hung up my suit, and arranged myself in bed with my plush Opus. Only then, alone in that cocoon of light and darkness, having sufficiently savored the anticipation, did I open the envelope from Katrina. The front of the card featured pink cartoon hippos making merry. A note was written inside. My dearest William, the mad bomber. Ever since I heard the news, I haven't been able to stop laughing. I know I shouldn't, but I think about it, and it just sets me off again. You're the only person I know who could get himself into a predicament like this, and that's why I love you so much. I'll be thinking about you tomorrow, but I'm not going to worry. I know you won't go to prison, because Heavenly Father would never let anything bad happen to one of his missionaries. I know you'll get through this and come home to me safe. Be brave. Your loving fiancé, Katrina. I read the note four times and tried to take comfort from Katrina's faith, but I couldn't manage it. God protects his missionaries? I knew better. I could think of two dramatic counterexamples right off the top of my head. When I was 10 years old, stories in the local news of a kidnapped missionary had made quite an impression on me. Elder Kirk Anderson was serving a mission in England when he was abducted by an ex-girlfriend named Joyce McKinney and a male associate of hers. McKinney, a former Miss Wyoming sick with love, had spent all her savings to trail Anderson to England. She kept him shackled and handcuffed in a remote Devon cottage for 3 days, performing all manner of sex acts upon him before setting him free. Many observers sniggered when Anderson accused McKinney of rape, and for her part, McKinney defended the sex as consensual. She claimed, in fact, to have lost her virginity to Anderson 2 years earlier, and that he was lying about the situation in the cottage to escape excommunication. Be that as it may, she very likely did kidnap him with chloroform and a rubber pistol, which must have been traumatic for Elder Anderson. No matter how good-looking your abductor, or what kinds of interesting uses she might put you to, when you're screwing a psycho, there's no guarantee she won't cut your throat in the afterglow. As disquieting as I found this story, particularly as a sexually frustrated missionary, far more upsetting was the case of elders Gary Darley and Mark Fisher, who disappeared late in 1974 after a dinner appointment with a recent convert named Robert Cleason in Austin, Texas. Their bodies were never found, but Elder Fisher's name tag was discovered with a bullet hole through it, and blood and hair, which could have belonged to both missionaries, was recovered from the housing of a taxidermy saw in Cleason's shop. Cleason, a man with a history of violence, was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death in 1975, despite the lack of corpses. In 1977, Cleason was released from prison after an appellate court disallowed the search warrant that had permitted police to enter his trailer. Bad things do happen to missionaries, and even in 1987, I knew it well. If God couldn't or wouldn't protect his missionaries from psychotic stalkers and crazed killers, even beneath the garments that were promised to be a shield and a protection to them, what reason did I have to expect him to keep me out of prison? I clutched Opus close, breathing deep of Katrina's perfume, and vainly tried to imagine I was safe at home in Utah.
Next time on The Accidental Terrorist.
In our next installment, Elder Shun goes to trial, only to learn that the Crown Prosecutor's Office has elevated the charges he faces. Will Elder Shun face life imprisonment? Can a plea bargain possibly save him? Will Doper, Weed, and Mad Dog get excommunicated for showing up at the courthouse? Why is that darn judge calling a 24-hour recess? And what about Joseph Smith? The pistol-whipping answers.
Just 1 week from now!
The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2007-2009. By William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.